I keep starting to do podcasts because there's so much changing right now, and it's fascinating to see, and even more fascinating to try to imagine what it's going to be like in a few days, weeks, whatever. It's very analogous to where we were as COVID was just starting to install itself. I did a podcast then too, about at this point in time, only maybe a little bit earlier for COVID, when it was very clear that it was going to infect, it was going to put us all on lockdown, it was going to kill a lot of people, and how the hell are people in our world going to adjust to that? You know, the feeling was we're just so damn spoiled that we even the slightest perturbation is too much, we can't handle it. And what's even funnier is that how we all went through that, and I don't know, a lot of people say it's not over, but it feels like it's been over for a while because we don't wear masks. Well, I know people do, but anyway, it feels like it's over. It is over. And we snap right back to it. We can't believe it. It can't happen here. Yet here it is. It's happening, right? So one thing you hear, and obviously there's so many things, it's like we're being hit from every fucking angle. The totality of it is that the people in charge want to destroy as much of the United States, which means really the world. I can explain that if you want, but as quickly as they can before anybody can stop them. And the connection that I made today is that that is almost exactly what happens in tech, because it's amazing how it's, I've been so close to this that I totally didn't even see it. That, you know, we had a really good thing going on the web in, I'm going to say, all the way up to about, I don't know, 2006, when Twitter came out. And Twitter turned us in a very important different direction. Not quite 180 degrees opposed to the direction we were headed in. At well over 90 degrees, though. And because it took out most of the features of the web. It did to the web, to the web, yes, what Musk and et al. Want to do to the world. The web was a great writing medium. They took out all the features. It stopped being a great writing medium. You know, my hope for the web was that it would be a new enlightenment, that intellectual discourse wouldn't know any boundaries anymore, and there wouldn't be any boundaries for that, and that we could route around all the gatekeepers that exist, that keep good ideas out. And for that, I went to the place where all the gatekeepers are to try to get them in. Let's come on into the web. This is great. You're going to love this. Who did I go to? I went to Harvard University. I could have probably gone to MIT, but I didn't want to go there because I didn't want to go to the nerds. I wanted to go to the sociologists and the physicists and the lawyers and all of the things other than the technology people, because I felt that none of this came from the technology industry. The thing that liberated us came from a research from a very Harvard-like place in Europe, where a single individual thought, hey, this would be cool. Let's try this idea out. It's exactly what I wanted. That whole story, it's not a story. It's what really happened. And it's why the web was and still is so wonderful. It's something you can understand in an afternoon fully. And that's the thing that made it so hard to understand at first, because there's almost nothing there. But that's, of course, the best kind of technology. And so I went to the place I went to the gatekeeper place, and I said, "Hey, you know, let's do this." And what happened was predictable. The people that were already in, well, why do we need to do that? We can already publish whatever we want, whenever we want. All they have to do is call up the New York Times and say, I want to write an op-ed. And they say, yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. How can we help? Should we send somebody up to like help you out, do this? You know, because whatever. These people had the credentials. They were in demand. And but it still was a great place to do this. And that's why it's so disturbing to see that, they've taken aim at the universities. They want to delete the university, the whole idea of a university. They don't believe in it. Now, that's really radical, right? And I believe it's totally wrong. I think that what we're going to have to do after they do this, if they succeed at doing it, is we're very quickly going to have to rebuild the universities. Because what we're going to find out, and I don't think they have the right to force us to find this out. We have a say in this. We don't have to go with them on this adventure. If they want to create a world where there are no universities, God bless, go do it. But fuck you if you think you can do it to our world. We like universities. And I think the universities, like the Democratic Party, like the open web, like all of these things, have gotten lost in trying to be fair and trying to do the right thing and, you know, working at our slow pace and thinking, well, it'll all just work out eventually in the end. Somehow we don't know how, but, you know, because we're spoiled. We're spoiled. We really are. We couldn't handle COVID, but we did handle COVID. But we didn't feel able to do it. Our gears are stripped. We don't know how to react to this. But we do. We do. And we have to keep the universities. So I went to Harvard University in 2003. They had an interest. I knocked on the door. I was very persistent. I said, this is the place I need to be. And after, it took some convincing, and they let me in. They said, here, this is an off. They gave me an office on Harvard Square, you know, which is prime. I mean, I didn't even understand it at the time, but there is a whole hierarchy to the different locations for the university. And this was the best. This was at the center of all the action in the university. And what it meant was I could draw people to me and they would come. That's what it means to have this card. To have that card, they would come. And while I didn't get the insiders, I was able to get all kinds of great things to come together there. We had two blogger cons there, and we had a Thursday evening meetup that happened every Thursday. And we had a pulse. We trained a lot of people on how to blog. And we sent them out into the world. And the people we trained were people that really had a sense, because they had to decide to come to this thing. You know, it wasn't like we were out on the street, you know, handing out leaflets or anything. We probably should have done that, though. I don't know why. We had plenty of people. I didn't really, whatever. It was working. And what popped up was really a really big change in the political world. That was there were a lot of other worlds that came in there, but that was the really big one. It was part of the reason was that there was a confluence in timing and space. There was, I got there in 2003. Was it 2003? Yeah, I'm confused. But when I was there, let's put it this way. When I was there, the New Hampshire primary campaign was going on in New Hampshire, and we were in Cambridge. And New Hampshire may feel like it's far away from Massachusetts, but it's not. It's almost suburban. Where most of the people in New Hampshire live is in the southern part that's adjacent to Massachusetts. And so getting to the campaign events was pretty easy drive. And we went to a lot of those things and we met the people who were running the campaigns and we told them about what we were doing. And what we found was a lot of them were already getting started with blogging. They thought, oh, this is cool. This is another way to communicate. And it wasn't something that the whole campaign, by no means did the campaigns understand what they had, but there were people on the campaigns that did, and we got them all together. And then they went back out in the world. And that's what a university is for. It's like a heartbeat. It's like blood comes in. It goes to the lungs where it's oxygenated, and then it goes out into the whole bloodstream. Then it comes back, and then it gets pumped back through the lungs again. And it's just, that's the process. And we don't use our universities well enough. That's probably one of the reasons why they're so susceptible. The model that universities take and have always taken is that you come to a university when you're young, you know, you're a teenager when you start, and maybe you go through a graduate degree, but by the time you're in your middle 20s, no matter what, you're out of the system and you're out in the world. And so there's this idea that there's university and then there's the world, and they're not the same place. Although there's a lot of confusion about that. In the university, they think when they send a computer science student out into the world, that they're ready to teach all those losers out there in the world how to really do it, because they've been doing student projects. There's a really big difference between a student project and something that can hold up under a load and be supportable and evolvable. I mean, you never there's never a version 2 of a student project, so you don't learn anything about code maintainability in that environment. And that's probably true in every discipline. It just happens to be where I got my education, was in computer science. A much better model would be, you come there when you're young because you're going to get the very basics of your education, but you come back maybe every 10 years for a full year, and you are both a student and a teacher when you do that. And teaching isn't done only in a classroom. It's done in a lab environment. The same way, you know, teaching hospitals are much better places to get medicine than a non-teaching hospital. I don't know why that is, but it's well known that it's true. So my feeling is that every university, and again, I'm going to be in terms of computer stuff because that's what I know, but I think these same ideas apply to really every discipline, is that every university should own an open source project. One that isn't, that it, you know, it's owned by the university probably and licensed to the world under some established license. It could be GPL, it could be MIT license, it could be Creative Commons. These are the things we have right now. And of course we would use one of the existing ones. There's no point reinventing something here. And it would gain a reputation for putting people into the world who are very, very skilled at developing in the world that it defines. And so there's your pulse. I come back after 10 years and I've been leading a development team, programming, but I come in and I do teach how to be in a development team, but I also learn how to be in a support team or, I don't know, evangelism, quality assurance, evolution of user interfaces, how to steal ideas from other products, you know, and I just think that really is important. I think that people, because we are, no matter how much evolving we do, no matter how much superior the Silicon Valley man is, what do they call them, the tech bros, they aren't really superior. I have to give you a clue on that one. We didn't make a new kind of human being there, folks. You have to go look in the mirror someday. I mean, you're getting old and you don't have that much more time to live. And I think you have to deal with that, that you don't get to rewrite the rules. Nobody gets to be as great as these people think they want to be or think they should be. But they won't know that until they destroy things. But there is really hope. I have to say that. I heard an interview, and I'm going to hopefully make this the very last thing in my little spiel here today. I heard an interview yesterday with Heather Cox Richardson, who is one of the very few people I read every night. Her piece comes out sometime in the middle of the night. She writes, I don't know how she does it, but there it is. And she's a historian, and she writes about the times we live in from a historical perspective. And that's invaluable. It's incredibly useful. And one of the things she said yesterday was something that I had pretty much concluded myself, is that we're totalitarianism, fascism, undemocracy, whatever you want to call it. I mean, what Trump is trying to put together is truly nasty shit. I mean, it's, it's really, but the problem with that, and that does take hold in some cultures. It does. But the reason why, and there has been time, like she asked a question yesterday, is like, and this is something apparently that's debated amongst historians. It's a good thing to debate, by the way, is when Germany and Italy and other countries turned fascist in the 1930s, why didn't the United States? And that's a fair question. You know, I mean, our cultures, whatever, a lot of us are European descent. We're not that different, you know, from a DNA standpoint. We were going through a Great Depression. The bottom had dropped out of the economic system everywhere, not just in the places that turned fascist. And her hypothesis, and the one that I had come to myself, is that the difference is every American was raised in a country that had the Bill of Rights. So you tell us that we don't get to speak, and I don't think we understand what you're just saying. What is that? How does that work again? I mean, people are scared. They are spoiled. They are self-interested. There's way too much of what's in it for me when we should be working together. It's not how you win in a situation like this. There's got to be a lot more, at least some selflessness around, where we work for each other. And, that wasn't, the United States was collective that way during the war, from what I understand. I mean, obviously, I wasn't alive then. But just looking out for what's in it for you is not a way to win a war. We all have to pull together. And the thing is, we all have to pull together even when it's not a war. And that's been my, really a bummer, is that, I was told that when we develop on the web, we are going to be doing that. We're going to be putting our work out there, and we're just saying, all right, you want to steal that idea? That's great, because it's a good idea, and it took me a while to figure it out. And I want it to proliferate, and I don't want to lock users in. That's sort of basic premise of the web. But then what you find out is that people don't give back. They don't return the favor. And the day you see that happen for the first time, it's really, what's the right word? Disheartening, I think, would be a really good word. It's like, how does this thing work again? I thought we were supposed to help each other. I thought that's what the web was about, you know? But going back to the idea of how to do the thing with the universities, I wrote about that years and years ago. It was one of the gestalts I had from my time at Harvard, was that we need to go back. It shouldn't just be a one-time thing. It should be something that's a pulse. And I called it building better developers. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me, it was developing better developers. Of course, it wouldn't be any fun if it was building better. It's developing better developers. It's a meta thing. It's like, what would the development process be for really good developers? What if the goal is to have students come out of the university with the exact right idea about how the commercial world works, about realities in software, and like, whoa, what do you, I mean, I took three courses in quality assurance, so I already know what the issues are in there, you know? I think everybody should take a class on how to write a good bug report. I think that should be like English 101 for the world that we live in now. But I guess that's it, is that we're going to change. That's the thing that is for sure now. We're going to change. And there's reason to be optimistic about what that change will be like. And so I wanted to leave you with that idea. And I very much wanted to disabuse you of the idea that we need to delete our universities. We need to make our universities work better and do more for us. But you don't take down the infrastructure and think that you're going to get it back anytime quick. Well, actually, that was another thing I was going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about it, but I'll leave a little note here. I went to New Orleans, where I went to college, so I knew the town after Katrina, just to see what it was like. What was a post-apocalyptic America like? And that was the thing that I saw, was that the bottom had been knocked out from under the foundation had been knocked out from under the city. And I could see how it was never going to come back. It couldn't come back from that. And I bet if we go down there today, you would see that it's still coming back from that, even though it was 20 years ago, over 20 years ago. So that's the same thing for the rest of us. We really do want to try to put a stop to this, because it's what's happening here is really bad. Okay, I'll leave you with that, and have a nice day. Talk to you later. Bye.